I shouldn't post enough to that?
I think so, well, first of all, I see that you were born in Baltimore County, and I wondered how you came to Harford County.
Well, my mother and father had lived here before. It just happened, they were living there at the time. My dad's business was in Baltimore. But they're both, my dad's family had always lived in Harford County, and my mother's family been in here for some time too in the county.
And what was his business?
Well, he was in charge of the U.S. Immigration Service in Baltimore, and he was called Commissioner of Immigration.
Mm.
And he commuted from to his work started to his own home here.
Mm-hmm.
But I was just chancing more or less. Their daddy was living near his business there in Baltimore.
Mm. What was his name?
Bertram Longstone.
And so then when you came along in 1900, did you live in Harford County?
I don't remember living anywhere else, because mm-hmm. I was about 3 years old when I was moved here to Harford County. We lived near Emerson,
mm-hmm.
down Route 24.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't remember any other place, really,
mm-hmm.
in Harford County.
And what was Emerson like? Can you remember much as a child what it was like?
Oh, yeah. It was a very small hamlet. It had an Episcopal church there, St. Mary's, and Mount Carmel, a Methodist church. It had one country store, a blacksmith shop, and the wheelwright was in with the blacksmith. And they had about, in a little village itself along the road, I guess there were about, only on Old Hamlet Road, they call it now, there were about six houses on the north side of the road. There weren't any on the other side. All the rest was just farmland. And the store was a combination post office and country store,
mm-hmm.
a rather small one. Mm-hmm. It was run by an old man called Warren and his daughter. And they had a old-fashioned desk, something like that there. Only the top of it was pigeonholes for putting in the mail.
Mm-hmm.
And the lower part lifted up, and that was where it kept his cash in the top part, it lifted up.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just a very small country store where you could get a few staples and, well, a surprising number of things, really, a few bags of feed and eggs and things like that.
Hmm.
And that was about an eminent amount of two in those days, but there were farms all around, of course.
Hmm.
And all the population of the town was very small, while there was a considerable number of people that traded there from the neighboring farms.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the mail came to Emerson from Edgewood. I think so. And you had to go to the post office to get your mail. That was before the days of rural free delivery.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the way Emerton was.
Hmm. Who were some of the farmers that had the farms in the Emerton area?
Well,
do you remember
coming up from, say, down the Vanbilt of the lower part of the county on Route 24, there weren't very many farms along that road of any size till you got up to a farm called Constant Friendship. And that was an old hall farm. Goes back a long way. And that was the first really large farm.
Mm-hmm.
And across from that there was a farm owned at that time by Mr. De Gaulle, a Frenchman.
Mm-hmm.
Later on, it was supposed to be, wonder what he's related to the famous De Gaulle, you know, of France. But that was a fairly large farm, and that's now called Box Hill.
Mm-hmm.
And it's now under development.
Mm-hmm.
Although the De Gaulle part of it is not yet developed.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. But the part farther up, at Nancy's Corner, now called Bertie's Corner.
Mm-hmm.
Box Hill North is called now. That was the old Hall farm.
Mm-hmm.
That was a very large farm, very good farm. Up farms in the lower part of the county were not as good until you got real way down towards the river. They were good down there, but the intervening part, the farms weren't so large or so fertile.
Mm-hmm.
But the Hall farm was a very large farm. It ran back from the Emmerton Road all the way to the Law Bush Road.
Mm-hmm.
The Hall family were a very old landowning family here in the county. It goes way back to revolutionary times, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
And then north of that came, went up the road, the next largest place was Judge Walter Preston's farm. He was a great man.
Mm-hmm.
He was a banker and a lawyer and a judge. And his brother was Mayor of Baltimore, Jim Preston. And his main business was the law and banking, but he loved his farm just the same.
Mm-hmm.
But his house is still standing there. It's called, surrounded by developments now, called Preston Manor, just above Birch's Corner.
Mm-hmm.
And he and his wife, Mrs. Lily Preston, lived there, great friends of ours, been fairly close.
Mm-hmm.
And then coming up a little farther was a farm a little farther up the road where some relatives of mine lived, Dr. Stump. He was a retired doctor and he didn't farm himself. He rented it out and had a tenant there.
Mm-hmm.
And then next up the road about out to St. Mary's Church was a farm originally fronted on the road, belonged to Mr. Davy Wilson, was a lawyer in town, but he had a pretty large farm there.
Mm-hmm.
And worked on the way up the road. You could name every farm almost.
Mm-hmm.
And who lived there.
Mm-hmm.
And who the tenants were or who operated the farm. Most of the farmers were, I guess, about half and half. Some of them might say were owner operated farms.
Mm-hmm.
And others, like my daddy and Mr. Judge Preston, they generally had tenants.
Mm-hmm.
That farmed on the shares. Well, sometimes they just hired men to do the farm work and they supervised it, but they weren't what you might call dirt farmers. But they still loved the rural ways.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the way the farms were. They were tend to be large, and the way they were just a landowner, his family, and a tenant living in the place. Now you have a development with a half acre lots or less.
Mm-hmm.
And
what was your farm like?
Well, it was 200 acres. It was fronted on Law Bush Road at the intersection of St. Mary's Church Road.
Mm-hmm.
And it was about half in woods. So it couldn't be construed as really a very large arable farm. And my father, having his business in Baltimore, he had a ton of farmers.
Mm-hmm.
Mostly, once in a while, he had a man that farmed independently, but he had a ton of farmers.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just a general crop farm. It had the grains, wheat, corn, oats, and maybe in good years try to get a little cash out of tomatoes or tomatoes.
Mm-hmm.
And so they were coming far up the road. The Magnuses were large landowners.
Hmm.
Lee Magnus and my uncles had a large farm laid back on a wheel road between the wheel road and the Emmerton Road. Yeah, their farm ran around 500 acres.
Mm-hmm.
Two brothers, my uncle, the boy and Alex Bell.
Mm.
And it was the same way all the way up to Bel Air, mostly large farms. Hmm. And then about the only people that are living on a farm now, I recall Tom Brooks and his mother. Mm-hmm. They still live on a farm on Ellington Road, just south of Patterson Mill Road.
Hmm.
And it used to be sad, and my family told me that at one time all the land, beginning from about here, mm-hmm. what was known as the Homestead Estate, the Homestead Farm, was owned by the Fernandez family. And they owned all the land running on the Emerton Road from where the town of Bel Air ended in those days, which is right here, mm-hmm. all the way down, including to the Brooks Farm near Emerton.
Mm-hmm.
That was running on the road, of course. I wouldn't say how far back their mm-hmm. land holdings went, but the time I began to know anything, that farm had been broken up mm-hmm. to a certain extent, the small places.
Mm-hmm.
But that was the way farms were then.
What was it like growing up on your farm?
Well, it was an ideal way to grow up, in my way of thinking. There were plenty of ground to run around in, to explore. We had woods, we had fields, gardens. My dad loved gardening, and he had a large garden, flower garden, vegetable garden.
Hmm.
And we could run around anywhere and get into our own little mischiefs and troubles.
Mm-hmm.
And it was really, really a nice way of growing up, except that in those days you were much more isolated. We didn't know very many, there weren't very many young people my age around, it seems to me, and we didn't have the mobility in those days that you have now with cars. Because to go anywhere involved hitching up a horse and getting it ready to a buggy, curing him, feeding him. And that would take about 20 minutes or so. And then if a drive was 3 or 4 miles, that would be another 30 minutes or so. So children stayed put, more or less, except to go to school.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a very small school at Emerton, public school. That was on a wheel road. Still there, a little stone building. Now occupied as a residence, I think. We had about 20 kids at the most, one room, and the other school was a public school at Van River along Hamilton Road. That was just at the top of the what we call Snow's Hill, where it's called Snow's Manor now, something like the development. It stood in a grove of trees. That was a little one-room school.
Mm.
And well, Harford County has changed greatly since, well, say 1910. Before World War I, Harford County was purely agricultural, I might say.
Mm-hmm.
The Batty Shoe Company was not here, and all you had in Bel Air were professional lawyers, doctors, and residents of the town.
Mm-hmm.
And, well, maybe you can get at it this way by imagining how things were. Let's say first that there were no government posts, Aberdeen and Edgewood. All that was farmland, large farms, see. Then there was the Pennsylvania Railroad and the B&O Railroad. They were the only means of getting to Baltimore with any speed, if you wanted to walk or drive. Then you say, you can imagine that there was no Route 40. And all the businesses, all the automobiles, all the restaurants and everything else, you imagine not being there at all, see? Nothing.
Mm-hmm.
Because the Kennedy Highway was not there. and that left the Old Post Road, Route 7, was the only highway north and south in that part of the county. Mm-hmm. And I first remember it as being a, you might call it an improved dirt road. The hills were sort of piped here and there with stones, rough stones put in, and gravel. And every spring they'd go out with road scrapers and spread gravel and level of the dirt road and make it a little more passable. But you can imagine what a difference that would be with from now with all the government grants in private hands and the Kennedy Highway and the Route 40, not there, nothing there was formed. Mm-hmm. And the Emmerton Road, we called it the road from Bellhead Edge, Grand River and Edgewood, was just a dirt road with the hills sometimes with gravel on or a little bit of stone. Mm-hmm. And back in the horse and buggy days, in late February and early March when the frost was coming out of the ground, some of those roads we'd call be almost impassable. Buggies with horses could hardly pull through. Sometimes it might be that they say axle deep, but it really wasn't that deep. But it was pretty deep at times. Mm-hmm. And of course there were only automobiles didn't come in around here as I remember till about, well, I guess the few here around 1905 or 6 maybe, just a few. Mm-hmm. And the farmers hauled their stuff between from the railroad stations in big farm wagons with probably 4 horses pulling. Mm-hmm. And one man would ride a horse or walk alongside of them. And then he'd load up the riding in the spring, they'd haul fertilizer up from Van River Station on big wagons. And they would be very hard on the road because they'd sink deep into the mud where the frost had left the ground very unstable. Mm-hmm. And even buggies, wagons had a hard time to get over these roads. Mm-hmm. Sometimes they'd freeze in the spring overnight from muddy conditions. Mm-hmm. The next morning it'd be frozen stiff and be deep ruts, frozen, and a narrow buggy would get in a rut sometime, and you had to be careful if you tried to turn your horse to one side or another. We either break the wheel or break the shaft because the wheels couldn't get out of the rut. And I bet some days that in the winter, the horse-drawn vehicles, I don't think it'd be more than maybe 2 dozen would pass up and down the Emmerton Road in a day. Mm. And now they're bumper to bumper almost. Mm-hmm. You know how it is. Mm. That's the difference. But it was a nice life. You had the landowners, and they almost knew each other, and their pleasures were simple. The telephone was just coming in around 19, the rural areas, about 19, the time we moved. Mother and father built the house in 1903. The telephone was, we had it put in a year or so later, I think. But that was one of these crank telephones with a party line, about quite a number of people on it. And the service was considered wonderful then, but now he couldn't put up with it. He had about 10 people on the line, maybe more. Mm. And dinner time, supper time, they'd all want to talk, you know. So things were very different then. Mm. And all the, after World War I, at that time, the county began to change, in my opinion. The army moved in at Edgewood and Aberdeen, and that began a change in the general mode of life. Hoffa County had been pretty provincial up to that time, but they brought in people from soldiers and officers, and the officers mingled with the local residents and went to some of their social functions and things like that. And they gradually became more cosmopolitan then, and also it was a large source of employment, as it is now. But that marked the beginning of the change then, with the automobile coming in about that time too. And people from out of the county began to buy up farms and estates. Some people from the city wanted to sort of establish a country home around. Mm-hmm. And some of the older landowners died off, their farms were sold that way. And it began a gradual change. But the automobile made a big factor in the change, and increasing population. Then Mr. Longley, he had a large farm called Long Bar Farm. All that developed now, Long Bar Harbor. But he put together some farmland down there, and then he got the shoe company to come here. Bill Longley. Mm-hmm. And that was the first industry in the county of any size. Down at Abingdon, I guess it's near Stepney, was the sewing factory down there. I don't know, probably maybe 15, 30 people or so. They call it Stack Sewing Factory. A check, I think he was. Mm-hmm. And that's no longer there. Mm-hmm. So that's sort of a general overview of early days as I remember in the county. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Well, now, where did you go to school?
Well, start out with, I was my sister and brother, we were taught at home. We had the Calvert School had a correspondence course. And members of our family, another local lady, Miss Alice Wilson, a neighbor, lived with us during the winter. And she taught us the elementary school to this correspondence course. Mm-hmm. And then for a couple of years, I commuted with my father into the Calvert School in Baltimore and went to attended the regular school there in Baltimore. Hmm. And I got a fondness for traveling on trains then. And you know, it was an interesting thing. Hmm. Because trains were the only way of getting around at any speed. Hmm. And horses were the only way on land before automobiles, of course.
Where would you catch the train to go to Baltimore?
Well, Van River Station was on the B&O. And I think that railroad came through in about 1885 or something like that. Before that, anyone wanted to go from Bel Air or lower part beyond south of Bel Air, they had to go to Edgewood on the Pennsylvania Railroad. That was the earlier railroad. And we had good train service. There were at least three accommodation trains going into Baltimore in the morning you could get. The early train was called a milk train because it hauled a lot of milk. Farmers would come down their wagons with a big five-gallon can and later 10-gallon cans of milk. And they'd haul it into Baltimore in the baggage car. Accommodation trains that had to make about 15 stops between Van Bibber and Baltimore. Mm-hmm. But Van Bibber being a station, you might say, for Bel Air in those days. Of course, they had the Maryland Pennsylvania Railroad too, but I don't recall when that came through. I think at any rate, for north and south travel, the B&O offered fairly good express service in Van Buren, because if people want to go to Philadelphia, New York, or Washington, you could get some of the good express trains in Van Buren. But now, Van Buren Station itself is gone. There's nothing there to show there had been a railroad station there. There's a railroad station, a store, and quite a number of houses still there. And around that area has been developed a lot of houses all through the Van Buren area now. Mm-hmm. But that was named for old Judge Van Buren. Lived in the Van Buren house here, mm-hmm. you know, on Main Street. And that's how it got its name, Van Buren. And they had water tanks there, or a water tank where engines took on water. Mm-hmm. Of course, there's all steam engines there. Two side tracks, and they had a big warehouse where they'd store things like fertilizer coming in for the farmers. They'd unload it from the cars into the warehouse, and then the agent would call up the farmer and say, your shipment's here, whatever it was, fertilizer or food or coal. And they also had, I think at one time, a ramp for loading cattle. There were a good many feed cattle, beef cattle farms here. And they'd, before trucks came in, they'd just drove them along the country roads. I remember meeting droves of cattle. We had all the farmers' family, kids, and all, they'd get out with long switches, and they'd be driving these cattle, and sometimes they'd try to break off, and they'd come to pass with a car or in a buggy or something, mm-hmm. and they'd have a big excitement, and they'd drive them down to the railroad station, and then they'd be shipped from there in cattle cars. Mm. So, of course, I don't think there were very many cattle farms here. I'm not positive that they had a cattle corral and loading chute at Van Buren, but I know they did, I think, at Joppa. Mm-hmm. And that's the way farmers got their livestock to market, large quantities of them.
Did you have chores and things to do on the farm?
Chores of things?
Chores?
Well, not too much. We were allowed to raise our own chickens. And I had a horse, a pony rather, supposed to look after, but my father had to have three or four horses to use in his commuting and driving. Mm-hmm. Every day to Van Buren Station. So we had a man that looked after the horses and the gardens and things like that, outside the yard man. Mm-hmm. But the most farm boys, that say, tenant farmers, their sons, they had a lot of duties that they helped with, cutting firewood and all usual things like that. Mm-hmm. But we helped when we could. I know, remember in harvest time, we'd help the tenant farmer harvest crops like wheat when you got a big rush on and so forth. But we were quite fortunate as kids. We didn't have an iron-bound schedule to follow and form chores like tenant farmers mm-hmm. schedule would. Mm-hmm. But it was a nice life. I don't know how youngsters make that. They're out here in the country, but say their home's on a small plot of ground, you know. Mm-hmm. And there's nothing much that they can do there. Maybe mow the lawn, help that. It was not very inspiring. Mm-hmm. But they don't have woods waiting to run free through exactly. And there's a big difference in the way children are brought up, because in those days, the children that did help with the farm work, when they got through the school and they did a little farm work in the winter, they'd be tired at night, and you didn't want to go, the horse and buggy go out joyriding and he retired. And the summer was even busy, you know. So they didn't get around. They didn't have the mobility. They didn't have all these meetings and sports. There were no sports in connection with public schools in those days. And all the playgrounds and the publicity you have in the evenings now, pages given over to football, basketball, and pictures. There wasn't any of that. There were no sports in the public schools.
Mm-hmm.
Way back.
Mm-hmm.
But the towns had little pickup ball teams. Everyone had sort of a makeshift team. We used to play Van Bibber and some of the neighboring towns. Yeah, just a pasture field. Have a little diamond laid out.
Mm-hmm.
But
Well, now, when you, after you... Well, most of the people in Harper County, they didn't get to go to school.
There were a good many from Bel Air that went to Princeton University. That was seemed to be a popular place in those days.
Hmm.
The Hopkins didn't have the reputation then as an undergraduate school. They were more or less in the beginning of the undergraduate school at Hopkins. And there were a number of men from around here that went to Princeton University for being fairly relatively close.
Mm-hmm.
There was Mr. Ned Holland, and the oldest one I can remember, well, Judge Preston was a graduate of Princeton University.
Hmm.
Mr. Ned Holland, old, was a graduate, and I can't, there were a number of others. I think Mr. Lewis Williams went to Princeton University.
Hmm.
So there were relatively fairly good number of people went to college in those days, but nothing like in numbers.
Mm-hmm.
Now everyone tries to go to some form of college, whether it's just community college or others, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But you're right, there weren't very many went to college, really, in those days.
Mm-hmm. Well, what was the opportunities like once you got out of college?
Well, nothing like they're on now. You could be a farmer. If your family owned a farm, you could sort of grow up and farm along with your father, and then inherit the farm and be a farmer, or owner manager of the farm.
Mm-hmm.
Or you could study for a profession, lawyer, a doctor, or go into the ministry. But outside of that, you have to go to a city to get employment around here, I'd say.
Mm-hmm.
The employment was very limited, except for the shoe factory and the government post. A good many people found it, a great many people found employment there.
Mm-hmm.
But if you want to get into business or something, you generally have to go to the city.
Mm-hmm.
There were two banks here, maybe three. There was a Commercial and Savings. That's the only bank that's been under the same the same corporate structure.
Mm-hmm.
That I think Judge Preston started that bank back in the 1900s sometime.
Mm-hmm.
And the other banks, all of them have been reorganized during the great banking troubles of the 30s,
mm-hmm.
or taken over by other institutions. But there was a Commercial Savings Bank and the Hartford Bank. And Offered National Bank. Well, now the First National Bank of Maryland is a head bank.
Mm-hmm.
And then a little later on came a Farmers and Merchants Bank. And that was on Arthur Street where the Johnson Credit Company occupies the building now.
Hmm.
So those were the only banks around, and they had no branches, except the Commercial and Savings had a sort of halfway branch down at Edgewood. A man went down there, Mr. Hall, and cashed checks and brought money up from the post to the bank here by carriage years ago. Now he wouldn't get from one place to the other, he'd be robbed.
Uh-huh.
But the county was much more peaceful. There was very little of this robbing, stealing, vandalism that goes on now. That's one of the shocking things.
Mm-hmm.
It seems to me we have a sick society. I don't know why, but where we lived, we had a nice home near Hamilton, and silverware, and valuable furniture, and then things, and it was never locked.
Mm.
We lived there from 1903 till 1937, and maybe once or twice, I remember, we were all away for overnight. We had a great trouble finding a key to lock a door.
Mm.
But, you know, these days, why, you wouldn't dare to do anything like that. It's a shame. I don't know why it is, but it is. It's more people, more mobility.
Mm-hmm.
And people can get around faster.
Yeah.
They were more easy to be caught in those days.
Mm-hmm.
Bel Air here, I don't know too much about Bel Air, but I think that they had one town bailiff here, and I think that was all.
Hmm. What was the rest of the town like? Do you remember coming in?
Oh yeah.
Child?
The town began about where High Street is. Mr. Bob High put up a stone residence there, and that was the last house down Emerton Road in the town, you might say.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a large farm. Right out here, from about where the Kenmore Inn used to be, now the Safeway stall,
mm-hmm.
and then it was Frank Jacobs' house, the old Hayes house that's been removed, and there were a few other houses, and then Mr. High's house, and all south of that was farmland, no developments. Just large farms.
Mm-hmm.
Going down was the Richardson's farm and the Fernandez farm and the Money Kaiser farm and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
But Bel Air was a quiet, sleepy town. I think I first remember Dad saying the population was about 1,200. I would say around 1910, something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And we were hitching posts in front of the stores on Main Street, where you drive up and hitch your horse to a hitching rack. The many stores had little counters came out over the street. And Bel Air changed a great deal since then. There are very few buildings in the town now. Commercial buildings, as I recall.
Hmm.
The old Busy Moon movie theater, I think that building's still sort of there. It's near where Jim's barber shop is. And the Cordon Hardware store was the old hotel, an old inn, years ago. I think it was called the Eagle Hotel. So, but Bel Air, I didn't know too much. You probably talked to people knew more about Bel-Air and Nolan Drake than I did.
Well, now, one thing I was a little curious, you said something about it. Why was Wheel Road named that?
I think it was because there was a factory, a small establishment there that made buggy wheels. I'm not positive of that. Now the Ring Factory Road, that's another oddity. And I asked Mr. Sterling, who was a longtime resident of that area where the Ring Factory Road goes through, how it got its name. And I thought maybe there was possibly people named the name of Ring lived there, or maybe there was some little establishment that made some sort of a metal ring. But he said it was a little place that made ring-shaped things they used in textile mills. But I don't know just what sort of a ring it was, the textile machinery. Now I think it was located on Winter's Run somewhere. And that's how the Ring Factory Road, they call it a factory. Of course, in those days there were mills, you could call that an industry, there were a number of mills around, they're all of course gone. My uncle's had a mill that's on the Singer Road, and the mill itself was just off the road where you cross the Winter's Run on the bridge. And they had a dam farther back, approximately where the site of the present Atkinson Dam is. The government dam. Of course, that dam was much smaller. It was only a few feet high. And they had a miller there, and farmers would come with corn and wheat and things to be ground. And then they'd often take back. There wouldn't be much exchange of cash. They'd have the wheat ground, and miller would take so much for his share, and then they'd get the flour. But those mills were dying out as I was growing up. The Western flour mills were taking over. They produced a better flour. It's just the economy of scale. But there's a lot of history about the Harford County mills. There's one, I remember on Patterson's Mill Road, there was a mill there. And the Hooker's Mill, that was farther down off of the Emerton Road. That was run by the family of Hookers, I imagine. But they were all in a declining state. In the early 90s, up to 1915, along in there, they were beginning to. Well, I think Bell's Mill went out, closed before World War I. And on the Wheel Road, instead of a mill, was a hydroelectric plant. The Bel-Air Electric Company had its main generating station there, and you can imagine they couldn't turn out very much power from Winter's Run there. But that was their main source of power. It's now covered, that site is covered by the Atkinson Lake. The Wheel Road is cut off there now by the Atkinson Lake. And then Mr. J. Alexis Shriver, originally was a promoter, the founder of the Bel-Air Electric Company. And then they had a small power plant, the Tyron Whitted, was running power generated through a diesel engine, I think. And that small substation was somewhere along Route 1 in the neighborhood of Lake Fanny. But the total horsepower was nothing at all. And the lights would often go out at night. I remember people would complain that lights would be, current would be weak, lights would go out due to the, in the fall the leaves would clog the races, mill races to, to the turbines, and the water supply would be shut off, diminished, you know, so the power went down, but that was sort of a natural thing. And Now on our farm, we only had kerosene lamps, as I first recall.
Mm-hmm.
And upstairs, we children were not allowed to have lamps because it was dangerous. A kid would upset a lamp, it would all flow out and burn, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And the fire department then were 4 miles away from Bel Air with a little fire department that had then. You were practically hopeless, you know, getting any great help. So we used candles to go to bed by and dress in the morning, candlelight for a long time. And finally we got to the home electric plant, had a house wired, and then along about 1920, I think we got what they call a high line, regular electric power. Was it then, sis?
No.
When did we get the electric power?
It was after I was married.
Was it?
Because the photographer came up and to take my picture. And he said, "Miss Stump, what's the matter? There's no current. I plugged the lights in." And I said, "Oh, well, we don't have electricity. We had our own plant in the basement before."
Mm-hmm.
And then that broke down, something happened to it. And we waited until the current came by the house. And the poor man was horrified. He walked off and scuffed. But that was in third, that was after I was 1931.
We didn't have electric power then. Our home generating plant had seen its best days, and it was out of commission, and we were just waiting to get the high power, but regular electric power.
Mm-hmm.
Would you have a cup of coffee now, or take a break, and
sure.
Here? The insurance companies had, the Hartford Mutual was a small company then,
mm-hmm.
And that was about the only business in Bel Air outside of the banks and the law offices, things like that.
Mm-hmm.
So I had an offer from, I was in college with the son, an old man, Firestone's son, was in my class.
Mm-hmm.
And they started up a college recruitment, and I went along, went after Firestone, and worked in a factory for a while, started learning the business, and then I went into sales work and like that. I was with him 3 or 4 years. And then my dad got quite ill, had a terminal illness, and I was rather unhappy out in Ohio, so I left them and came back. Then I worked for a telephone company after that in Baltimore, commuting on the B&O mostly, sometimes by bus. I don't know which was worse, a bus or a train. Sometimes I had to use both. If I had to work overtime in the telephone company, they never paid you any overtime. They give you what they call a supper ticket, 50 cents. And you could get supper on a telephone company, but maybe you put in 2 or 3 extra hours in a busy time. But the thing of it was that it was on a train, I'd missed my train. Then I was able to get a late bus out of Baltimore up here, but my car would be down in Van Bibber. So I had to get my sister, somebody, when we were living on the farm, to come up here in Bel Air to meet me, and then take me down to Van Bibber the next morning to going on a train. That was one of the tribulations. But I remember Dad saying that years ago, there was a stage went between Bel Air and Edgewood, and there were a few commuters then, and I think the stage left Bel Air at 6:30, or maybe 6, to get to Edgewood around maybe say 7, something like that, and then they'd board a train or accommodation train just to Baltimore.
Mm.
And of course, that was before my time. And there was a blacksmith shop in Emmett, and that was a quite a gathering place. It's right on the corner of the old Amherst Road and the Wheel Road. Mm-hmm. There's a house staying there. And I used to go out there and take a horse to be shod off, and you'd have to wait around, wait your turn. And the blacksmith was a typical blacksmith, Mr. Walter Everett. And he had a forge there, and a wheelwright shop too, and the horse and buggy would come by, and people would be waiting there, they'd all look out and say, oh, there goes old man so-and-so. I wonder how his horse, how he gets along, that old horse. And, you know, make remarks like that, all look and see a horse and buggy going by, and then they'd laugh and joke, you know. And now he's got a garage he's in place of. Yeah, the Everetts were great people around there. There was Mr. Our neighbor to the south was Mr. Joe Everett, and his daughter was Miss Estelle Everett, and she was very prominent here in the county juvenile services, the rudimentary services they had, and. She held that post for a long time. I don't know just the title that she had, but she was considered to be very, very good in that work. Judge Preston was influential in getting her that position, I think. Hmm. He was a great man, Judge Preston. He was very, very friendly, very jolly. He loved to laugh. And there were more people in those days seem to be characters. Everybody now is molded in a way. They're molded by the schools, mass education, mm-hmm. mass entertainment, the mass media. In those days, of course, there was no radio, and many people didn't have telephones, mm-hmm. and only a few people subscribed to a paper, the morning paper. And individuals were was a climate where individuals developed more, because you didn't have the sort of overall sameness that society's sort of afflicted with, you say that now, to the mass media, you know, and the propaganda agencies and television and all like that. I always remember old county surveyor, Mr. Walter Somerville. He was a character. He surveyed farms all through here, you know, change of land things. And he knew all everybody all around, miles around. He had an old Ford that went around it for years. He and his son helped him. And he was a well-educated man. He had a hobby of quoting Latin to people. I don't know whether it's to impress them with his knowledge, but he'd break out in Latin quotations sometimes, and he had funny little ways about him. He lived on some Somerville Road, named for him. His house, not there, burned down, but it's very picturesque old house, and a lot of old, nice grove trees around it and things. Hmm. And there were sort of a little more countrified people. You never hear people speaking of country rubes anymore. But there used to be country rubes around, you know.
What's that?
Yeah.
Now, I don't know what that is. What do you mean?
A rube? Well, sort of oddity. A chap with funny mannerisms, funny ways of talking, or things like that. Mm-hmm. There used to be a famous baseball pitcher named Rube Parnum, came from a farm. Rube. They were sort of guys, more or less uneducated, you know, but characters, one way, eccentric in a way, maybe. But generally good natured. Mm-hmm. And then they had farmers' clubs. There's a Boston Farmers Club, and then of course the Grange was more fact around here than it is now because, well, the number of farms is so much less. Mm-hmm. But these farmers' clubs, they would have a dinner meeting where the host farmer would have a big dinner. But before the dinner, they go out and make inspection of the barns and they report at the table. They say, we found so many cows, well tended, and so many barrels of corn, the hay in storage, and then they'd have somebody, maybe a local county agent, would give a talk on agricultural subjects, and then they'd have a nice dinner, mm-hmm. and maybe a little conviviality of drinking, and then they'd disperse, you know. Well, of course, that's all gone now. Not many, in this part, the lower part of the county, not many farms left, really, until you get up north of Bel Air. Mm-hmm. There are a few left south of here, of course, but there are also a few. Mm-hmm.
Was it hard? Were there many people commuting like what you were doing?
Well, from Van River, yeah, there were about, I guess it would be six or eight people. Regular commuters, and then often they'd be joined by their other members of the family. The ladies would be going into shop. It would be a great day. They'd go into shop at O'Neill's store in Baltimore. That was a great place for the ladies of the house to get their clothes or go to different dressmakers. And occasional people that way, a lawyer sometimes would be going to Baltimore. Mm-hmm. But the steady commuters from Van River, they were generally about my father and Mr. Bosley Ledig and Mr. D. Gall and about four or five generally. Hmm. And then as you went to Baltimore, they'd pick up more from Joppa, different stations down on the south. Mm-hmm. But sometimes there'd be quite a rush of people at the holidays. The trains would get crowded with shoppers going in. Mm-hmm. And in the spring, a little later in April, people would come out to Van River to go gudgeon fishing.
No?
Gudgeon fishing, the little fish would come up into winter's run down there. Uh-huh. And they'd come up on accommodation in the morning, bring a lunch, you know, and then they'd walk a few hundred yards down to Winter's Run. And that would be a big thing in the spring that the gudgeon fishers would come out from Baltimore. Mm-hmm. Maybe a whole lot of them, maybe 15, 20, you know, that was a big crowd in those days. Have some sugar.
Well now, you went back to the farm around the Depression?
Yeah, the telephone company began cutting back and single men hadn't been there too long. They were first to go, you know. Mm-hmm. I came back, a lot of people did. They'd fall back on the farm. We were lucky enough to have a farm. Mm-hmm. And that's when I did most of my farming. I didn't, wasn't really brought up as a farm boy. Mm-hmm. I had to learn. And our farm had been run down a good deal. My dad had been dead a number of years, and he had 10 farmers there, and they place tended to run down. So I had to do a lot of breaking up of old side fields that are overgrown, things like that. Mm-hmm. And we mostly just a general farm. We grew corn, wheat, mm-hmm. and later mostly for cash crops, tomatoes. Mm-hmm. There were a good many canned factories, so-called factories around here, little local places that Mr. Lee Magnus had one up in Amerton, mm-hmm. and farmers would haul tomatoes from their fields up to this canning house there at north of Amerton. It's off on Plum Tree Road, just off of Amerton Road. Mm. And there were others. There was one the canning house down at Van River, I think a small one. They're all gone now. But at one time we had 7 acres in tomatoes, and meant about 20,000 plants. And that was a job, drawing those things and putting them out. Oh boy, backbreaking.
Well now, did most people around here, was the Depression sort of it wasn't as hard as it could have been if you had a farm? Was that the way it was?
Well, no, farmers were relatively better off.
Mm.
They could have enough to live on and eat. They'd have grew most of their own vegetables, and they could store a lot of vegetables over the winter, like apples and potatoes, mm-hmm. and maybe carrots and parsnips, things like that. They could store those for winter use,
mm-hmm.
and so they had chickens, they had pigs, and sometimes they slaughter a calf or so.
Mm-hmm.
So the eating, they were much better shape than city dwellers,
mm-hmm.
much better. And of course, they could afford some of coffee and tea and things that, you know, star-bought and stuff, as they call it.
Mm-hmm.
But the prices, you can't imagine what the prices were so low then.
Mm-hmm.
Now, we sold tomatoes, we hauled tomatoes up to Magus' canning house, I did. And the lowest price, I think, was 32 cents a bushel. That was 60 pounds of tomatoes. And they were carried up there in what I call a tomato box. They held a bushel.
Mm-hmm.
They were sort of a crate. The slats and two ends in the center, dividing piece.
Mm-hmm.
And we loaded over 60 pounds of tomatoes, and then the weight of the box and all made about 75 pounds. It took a lot of tomatoes to make any money at that price. But you could, in those days, things were. Fertilizer was maybe, $8-$10 a ton. And I paid my pickers, some people paid them piece rate, so much a bushel. And I generally paid them by the day, because you got better grade of tomatoes that way. People working on piece work would pick a half-ripe tomato and that wouldn't be so good. Canning people would didn't like that, you know. They pick an overripe. Sort of a regular immigration almost.
And people around here, how'd they feel about them coming in?
Well, there's a little friction sometimes. But they're generally very, very good citizens, you know. They're farmers.
Mm-hmm.
And some of them are some of the most substantial farmers now, as you know, came from North Carolina.
Hmm.
And of course, he had some that weren't so good, like anything else. But on the whole, they were very fine.
Mm-hmm.
They were fine citizens. A lot of them came from around Sparta.
Mm-hmm.
Remember going to Sparta? It's just a pretty little place. I think it's on the western side of the Blue Ridges. I remember. It was a lousy day. We wanted to come up the Blue Ridge Parkway, but it was too foggy and rainy. We had to make a little speed, so somebody said, well, go down on another parallel road and went down to the valley more.
Mm-hmm.
I think Sparta was on that road.
Mm-hmm.
But you say your family originally came from North Carolina.
Mm-hmm.
What part around?
Asheville.
Hmm?
Asheville.
Yeah. Went to the river for an outing. And at Otter Point, it was Captain John Light had an establishment down there. He had a fishery there, and he also took people out boating. They'd hire a launch and go down Bush River in his big old launch. It was called the Otter. And before that, he had a sailboat. I don't remember the sailboat. I think it was called a Gypsy. To take people out into the bay, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
But his main thing there was his fishery at Otter Point.
Mm-hmm.
And the fish were plentiful then. And they had nets. I remember seeing big nets down in the lower end of Bush River. They'd fish those nets in little boats they called gilling skiffs. They're propelled by sail. And that was a regular commercial fishery. And they'd catch, bring that fish up to Otter Point, and then they'd ice them, and they'd be shipped to Baltimore. I don't know how, either by wagon or by train, and then later on by truck. but also they had a entertainment side of it. Besides crabbing, a lot of people would go down and they'd hire a rowboat and a crab line for days crabbing. That was a great sport. Crabs are plentiful, and you take you down the river, Ray, row down the river, Ray, put out a trot line. You get a bushel of crabs in a few hours. Nice crabs, they could cook them there for you. Mm. And that was one of the nice things to do. And of course, he crab commercially had soft crabs, had tanks that held these crabs, soft crabs and others. And they had the snapping turtles they get, and this fishery. And that was sort of a little industry of itself, the fishing down there. Mm-hmm. And they had big runs of shad in the spring, and farmers would go down there, and country people would buy a whole shad for 50 cents. Mm. Big thing, maybe weighed 6 or 8 pounds. And rockfish, I remember one of the watermen used to work for Captain Light. He said they got a haul of rockfish there in the upper part of Bush River. And I think it was over 1,000 pounds in one haul of rockfish. And that in the summertime, the people would go down there, and then they have picnic parties. You hire a rowboat and go down the riverway to Flying Point. It's Flying Point Park now, but that was all palm. Big dairy farm there owned by Mr. Fry, F-R-A-Y, and all that area through there. And he didn't mind. It was a nice sandy point there, in fairly deep water in those days. Mm-hmm. I mean, maybe 6-7 feet, it went down fairly quickly. And people would go down there for the swimming party. Then later on, the social establishment, more of a club affair, came into being, called a Harford Boat Club. And that was one of the main social attractions in the social way around here, because it was originally started as a sort of a gun club. It was a good duck shooting. People came down to New York even to shoot ducks in the Chesapeake Bay, the Bush River, and places like that. Mm-hmm. Especially more the duck shooting that was up on Susquehanna Flats. J. Pierpont Morgan had a big place on Spicesia Island. Mm-hmm. I remember being there, had a big gun club and all these tycoons, financiers, he'd entertained down there. He had gamekeepers, wardens, and blinds, scattered all out. But Bush River wasn't anything that elaborate, but it was a good deal of a sport. Duck hunting down there, fishing, and then the social way, this boat club came, and they would have dances there. It's now the Elks Club, but the old Harvard Boat Club building was framed, and it was destroyed by fire during World War II sometime. Nothing there now. It looks like the old Harvard Boat Club. Hmm. But it was a nice club. It had a number of boats there. There weren't too many really avid yachtsmen. Mm-hmm. But the younger crowd had nice dances. They had subscription dances, and people would come out in Baltimore. And Bob Euler used to play there. He was a great man that came out in Baltimore to play at social functions, you know, mm-hmm. around the county. Mm-hmm. And the Bel Air Armory, they used to, in the wintertime, they'd have two social gatherings. There would be the library dance. The ladies of the Risen Harford County Library would sponsor a dance there to raise money, subscription dance, mm-hmm. in the Armory, and then the Red Cross would do the same thing. And that would be the highlights of the social season in the wintertime for the younger people. Mm-hmm. These Armory dances would come, have a big band come up in Baltimore, mm-hmm. and all young people gather around, mm-hmm. and sort of have a big, really nice dances. That, mm-hmm. I guess it had 200 or 300 people dancing there. Mm-hmm. Floor would be cleared, all chairs be all up against the wall, you know, and mm-hmm. so forth. But the Harford Boat Club was quite a social center. It was before automobiles got too many, and it was within driving distance of Bel Air area and all the lower part of the county. Mm-hmm. But as time went on, people would go to Ocean City, got popular. See, people because they could afford to go to bigger, maybe better places.
Mm-hmm.
And the Harbor Boat Club sort of went into a decline and it passed out of business in, during World War II. All the younger people were, you know, in the Army, and there wasn't much social activity, was curtailed.
Mm-hmm.
But that was one of the nice things about the county, the water and the entertainment it furnished, and the profit of, and the source of income and from the fishery and crabbing and things like that.
Hmm.
All that's no more, all that's gone because you have large marinas there now. The Otter Point Boat Club and the Harford County Yacht Club at Long Bar Harbor, and then Trojan Harbor Marina down on the Edgewood side. And then there's another marina down near the Pennsylvania Railroad on Bush River. And I imagine there's, I would hate to say how many motorboats, power boats on the river now. And as I remember as a kid, there were just a handful of commercial fishing boats and a few launches, and the wealthy individuals have their own power boat, you know, and maybe 10 or 15, 20 power boats. There'd be a whole lot in those days.
Mm-hmm.
That's about it for me.